Hey, today we are going to talk about a financial company, the first one on Stock Stories, so let's check it out. Welcome to Stock Stories, Episode 8. Yeah, all right. Yes, this is Stock Stories, Episode 8. I'm Alex. I'm your host today. Thanks for joining me. And yeah, today we're going to talk about financial company. Thank you for listening so far. Hopefully you've enjoyed the other episodes. So far, we've talked about a couple industrial companies, and I want to switch it up a little bit. Let's talk about a financial company. And kind of mix it up, get into some different industries, and just explore what else there is in the S&P 500. So, if you've been following along so far, we've done two companies. We have covered General Electric and Sherwin-Williams, and today we're going to cover Discover Financial. So, without further ado, let's get into the episode. All right, so today we're going to be discussing Discover Financial Services. So we'll be going over a little bit of the history of the company, an overview of its business, its financials, of course, and its outlook. What do we think it's going to do in the future? Why should we care about it as a company or as a potential investment? And then a little bit about the valuation at the end. So what is Discover? So if you're from the United States listening to this, you've probably heard of the company. They are one of the major credit card companies here in the United States. They are kind of the little brother to the other big guys in the space, but they are still big enough to be considered a major credit card company. So the big four are Visa, MasterCard, American Express, and Discover Financial Services. So those are the big four in the US, and we're going to talk about some of the similarities and differences here and what can we specifically learn about Discover. So Discover, it's not that old of a company like the other companies we've talked about so far in Stock Stories. It was founded in just 1985, not too long ago, and it used to be a subsidiary of Morgan Stanley. And that Morgan Stanley used to be a subsidiary of Sears. So in the United States, credit cards actually originated pretty much from department stores. They were pretty much invented by department stores in order to get customers to borrow more money and have accounts with them so that they could charge interest in addition to selling clothing and other merchandise. So a little bit prior to that, though, the general invention of the credit card in general, this was invented by Frank McNamara back in 1950, and he invented the general purpose card, a charge card, so you had to pay it off every month. There was no revolving credit, but it was the first general purpose charge card, and it was the Diners Club card. So there was this invention of pretty much instant credit. And by 1958, the Bank AmeriCard, which eventually became Visa, was the first modern credit card with revolving credit. So you didn't have to pay it off every single month. And this was pretty revolutionary because now people could just go out and spend and they could think about it later. They could pay it off later. They didn't have to pay it off pretty much right away. And they also didn't have to write a check. They could just use their card, and they could use the same card at multiple locations, which was a pretty revolutionary concept. So Bank AmeriCard eventually became Visa. Citibank invented MasterCharge, which became MasterCard in order to compete with Bank AmeriCard. And so before long, you had these four companies: Visa, MasterCard, American Express, and Discover. Now, Discover, as I mentioned, used to be a part of Morgan Stanley, which used to be a part of Sears. So it got spun off from Morgan Stanley back in 2007, and it became independently traded in 07. So its publicly traded history, it's only 11 years long at the time of this recording. So it's a pretty new company as far as its financials and its history. So we have to look at the data that we have. So what does Discover do? What is it? So obviously we know that they have credit cards, right? So what are the different segments and how do they make money? So Discover has two different segments. They have direct banking and they have payment services. So Discover is actually both a credit card payment processor and a bank. So it's an actual bank as well as the people who manage the data. So in the direct banking segment, they actually make their own credit cards and market them directly to consumers. So they sell credit cards and then they do all the other things that you would expect a bank to do. They have accounts where they hold people's deposits. They lend money for student loans. They lend money for personal loans. They lend money for HELOCs, home equity lines of credit. And so they do all these things that banks do. So they are a bank. That's part of their business. Now, as we'll see later, 82% of their interest income, it comes from credit cards. So they're making most of their money off of credit cards, but they do also have these other products that they market to consumers. So what about the other arm of the business? What's payment services about? So payment services is all the transactional stuff. This is basically the toll booth of the financial world. When money changes hands, Discover can get a cut of it based on their network. So Discover owns the Pulse Network. And the Pulse Network is this international system that consists of 2 million ATMs, and it's in over 138 countries. And they essentially take a small portion of money for all these transactions at all of these ATMs. They also have network partners that they partner with around the world that pay fees for using the Discover Financial Network. And then another part of payment services is they own Diners Club. So that that original club formed way back in the 50s, they own the intellectual property to that. So they get royalties from that intellectual property as they license out the name to people around the world. So those are the two main parts of Discover, and that's how they make money. They make money through banking, mainly credit cards as a part of that, and they make money through processing payments. So before we get deeper into the specific business of Discover, I want to go over the basics of how does a credit card transaction actually work, since this is the majority of the money that Discover makes and the majority of the money that banks who issue credit cards make on them. So how does it actually work? So you have a card, you have a Discover card in your pocket, you pull it out, and then you go up to a merchant and you want to buy something. So you give the merchant your card and they swipe it. Now, as a consumer, that's pretty much all you see. And then all of a sudden, a receipt pops out and you're good to go and you've been approved for the transaction, and then you leave with your merchandise. Well, in that small period of time, what's happening is the merchant actually will send that data back to Discover, and then Discover will say, oh, hey, this is our card. This is the identity of the person who's buying this product. And yes, we approve for them to have this amount of credit immediately. And so they'll send that info back to the merchant and approve the transaction. And so the merchant will get the money from Discover, and then you as a consumer will get the merchandise and you'll leave. Now, eventually Discover will come back to you and say, hey, you bought this thing at the merchant and it cost this much, so you need to pay us back for it. And if you pay it within a grace period, you don't owe any interest. So that's the simplest cycle of transactions. It's like a triangle between you, the consumer, with your card, the merchant, and then Discover Financial. That's the simplest cycle of a transaction. Now, the more complicated one is there's a fourth party involved called the merchant acquirer. And the merchant acquirer is basically a middleman between Discover and other merchants. So sometimes merchants don't deal directly with Discover. These merchant acquirers have relationships with a variety of merchants so that when you swipe your card at the merchant's register, the merchant communicates with the merchant acquirer, and then the merchant acquirer communicates with Discover, and then Discover communicates with you. So then you have this the square going on instead of the triangle. So ultimately, though, it comes down to, at the point of sale, you're swiping a card or inserting a card, or maybe even using a contactless payment, which is becoming more popular now, and that credit is being extended to you instantaneously. And then you're getting a bill for it later, and then you pay it off. Now, of course, because it's a revolving account, if you don't pay it all off in the grace period, you're going to be charged interest on that money. And that interest is the bread and butter of the credit card industry. That's how they make almost all their money. So I want to talk about that a little bit, actually, about interest, because what actually sets those rates? I mean, so Discover is a bank, and so in that sense, they do set their own rates for their credit cards. So what does this rate come from? I know they're insanely high when you read the papers. It's like 18%, 19%, 20-something percent interest. So where does that come from? So in the United States fiscal system, you have what's called the federal funds rate. So this is the rate that the Federal Reserve has set to allow banks to lend each other money overnight in short-term loans. So this is kind of the foundation and where interest rates kind of stem from. So that is the starting interest rate. That the prime rate is based off of that. So the prime rate, you'll often hear that term, and the prime rate is what you would lend to somebody that is very credit worthy. So somebody who has excellent credit history, they're a quote unquote prime customer. So they would get the best rate. So there is a prime rate in the industry that is based off of the federal funds rate. And it's just a few percentage points above the federal funds rate, I believe. And so then Discover Financial bases their credit card interest rates off of the prime rate. So they'll add a certain percentage, a certain number of basis points is the term that they use. So 100 basis points equals 1%. So if you ever hear someone say, oh, well, you know, the interest rates rose by 50 basis points in a day, which I don't think would happen, but it could happen. Interest rates rose by 50 basis points in a day. Well, that just means that the federal funds rate rose by 0.5%. So that's the definition of that. But yeah, so that's the flow of interest rates. You have the federal funds rate, which influences the prime rate, and that influences the rates that everybody else charges for their loans, including Discover Financial, and the amount of rate they're able to charge customers. So let's get into the financials of the company, all right? So how is Discover Financial doing? Well, in 2017, they were profitable. Hey, that's a good first sign. They made $2 billion in 2017. Now in 2013, a couple years ago, they made $2.4 billion. So we're like, okay, this company makes money, but they're making a little bit less money than they did a few years ago. What's going on? So that was my immediate first question when I was looking at this income statement. And the revenue, though, it kept going up. The revenue growth for the past several years has been 10% growth a year. So I was like, what's going on here? The company is bringing in more and more cash every year, but its profit is pretty stagnant. So what does that mean? That means it has to be increasing its expenses somewhere. And so that's what I look to next. So the expenses have been trending up. So in 2017, there were $3.7 billion in quote-unquote other expenses. There were $1.6 billion in interest expense and $2.5 billion in provisions for loan losses. So what I learned by analyzing the income statement for Discover was that the main source of revenue is through credit card interest, like 82% of it. And so pretty much it's bringing in money through interest. And the expenses, you can break down the expenses for Discover Financial into three main categories. There's the expense of interest that they're paying on their loans. So Discover as a bank lends money and also borrows money to fund its operations. So there's interest expense there. There's loan loss provisions. So when Discover lends money, they know that there's a certain percentage of customers that just aren't going to pay their debt off. They're not going to pay them interest at all. They're not going to pay their principal back. And so they charge it off. Basically, they write it off as a loss. So Discover needs to put aside some money in order to account for these losses that they expect. And they have different algorithms and simulations based on the credit profiles of their customers to try to figure out how many of these customers are going to not pay up, and also the amount of money that they're not going to pay up. So the loan loss provision is basically setting aside this money ahead of time to say like, hey, here's some money that we know we're not going to get back probably. So that's the second category of expenses. The third category of expenses is other expenses, quote unquote. And I'm always curious when companies write this, like other expenses or other income, like what does that mean? So you have to dig a little bit deeper to understand what that is. So other expenses, these are things like the compensation for the employees, the marketing used for the products, all the Discover commercials that you see on TV, etc. So those are those kinds of expenses. So looking back through several years of data, in 2011, Discover brought in $8.5 billion in revenue, and that's steadily been increasing every year up through fiscal 2017 when they've made $11.5 billion in revenue. So they've been doing a good job at making more money as far as bringing in revenue. Their interest expense, it's been pretty much the same. I mean, it even decreased a little bit. It went from $1.5 billion in 2011 to $1.1 in 2014, and now it's back up to $1.6 billion. So they haven't been borrowing too much money here. And I also look at the taxes. In 2011, they paid $1.2 billion in taxes. And in 2017, they paid $1.4 billion in taxes. So, okay, all right, modest increase in tax bill, but pretty much the same. I mean, compared to the revenue, that's actually not that bad. So that tells me that the company is spending more money on the other two categories. They're spending more money on loan loss provisions, and they're spending more money on other expenses. And when I look into the income statement, that's exactly what I find. In 2011, the loan loss provisions were only $1 billion, whereas in 2017, they were $2.5 billion. So Discover is putting away more money for expected charge-offs. And it's also spending more money in other expenses. They went from $2.5 billion in 2011 to $3.7 billion in 2017. So Discover is putting more money back into its business, and it's also putting more money away for a rainy day, basically, knowing that the amount of charge-offs is going to increase. So what does that ultimately leave you with profit? Well, not as much. Like I mentioned, the profit has decreased from just over $2 billion to just about $2 billion over a several year period. So that's pretty much the story with the income statement. What about the assets though? What about the liabilities? Let's look at the balance sheet. So in 2017, Discover had $100 billion in assets. Pretty nice. 81% of that, that's in net loans. So $81.6 billion of loans and over $13 billion in cash. So this is pretty good. If you compare this to 2011, they've massively increased the number of loans that they have on their books. They've massively increased the amount of cash that they have. So these are good things. Back in 2011, they had only $2.8 billion in cash, and they only had $55.4 billion in net loans. So they've been able to increase their assets pretty steadily year over year. As far as the liabilities go, the liabilities are mainly broken up as far as the deposits that they have, because when they have accounts for people, the people are putting their money into the accounts, and it's not their money, it's the people's money. So that's a liability because they have to pay interest on that money to get customers. So those deposits have increased from $39.5 billion to $58.7 billion. So again, pretty much in line with the growth of net loans. So that seems pretty fair. Now, as far as the loans that Discover Bank owes, that's increased as well, but not so much. From $18.2 billion in 2011 up to $26.3 billion in 2017. So yeah, Discover is borrowing more money here, but not a crazy amount more than they used to. And so their overall liabilities, they have a few other items too. So their overall liabilities have increased from $60.8 billion to $89.2 billion over that 7-year period, which, that's not so bad. It's pretty modest, but pretty much in line with the growth of the assets. So the assets have grown by about $30 billion over a 7-year period, and the liabilities have grown about $30 billion over a 7-year period. So that shareholders' equity, that difference between the assets and liabilities, has stayed pretty consistent. So I think it's safe to say that Discover Financial is a business that has been growing their overall business and cash flows, but everything has been scaling up except for the equity and the profits. The profits have stayed the same, and the equity for shareholders has stayed the same. It's just that they have more assets and liabilities on the books than they did before, and they have more income and expenses than they did before. So this is an important lesson, I think, for us as individual investors. A company can be growing, but growing does not equal more profits. In order for a company to have more profits, the income has to be growing faster than the expenses. But if income grows equally as fast as expenses, then we're pretty much left in the same position as before. The only difference is that now maybe there might be more opportunity for cost cutting since expenses have ballooned. But there's also that pressure there, because if the income falls down to the levels they were at before, the expenses would have to drop the same amount in order to maintain the same level of profit margin. So just because a business is growing doesn't mean that it's making more money. And I think Discover is the perfect example of that. Let's turn our attention now to the cash flow statement. So in 2017, the operating income was $5.2 billion. And this has been steadily increasing too, from 2011 of $3.6 billion. But interestingly, between 2011 and 2015, the cash from operations didn't increase that much. It went from $3.6 billion to $3.8 billion. So virtually no increase in cash from operations over that 5-year stretch. But over the past 3 years, the cash from operations has actually been growing. It's been going from 3.8 to 4.4 to 5.2 billion. So we can see that the company has been making more money in that sense, as far as like a subset of its overall income. Now, cash flow from investing. So they have been investing more money. So it went from $2.8 billion to $4.9 billion in 2016 to $8.7 billion in 2017. So this is where we include things like those loan loss provisions. So that's a lot of money right there accounting for that. Now, let's look at the financing. Cash flow from financing has gone up from $1.3 billion in 2015 to $2.8 billion in 2016 to $4.9 billion in 2017. So a pretty steady increase there. And this is partially due to borrowing more money. So of that, they've been borrowing more. But let's look at the debt paid. So Discover has been borrowing $6.1 billion last year, but they paid off $4.9 billion of debt last year also. Contrast that with 2015, for example, they borrowed $5.6 billion, but they paid off $3.6. So overall, we see that, yeah, they're borrowing a little bit more than they're paying off, but it's not anything crazy. It's not like General Electric's debt load or something like that. So let's look at the dividends. So dividends are an important part of shareholder returns sometimes. In the case of Discover, they've pretty much been paying out not the same amount of dividends, but a small percentage of their overall profit. So they've been paying out about $500 million in dividends, and they've been increasing that steadily the past few years. Now here's where things get a little interesting. Discover has been spending money on buybacks. So they have been buying back a lot more of their shares lately than they used to. Back in 2011, they only bought back $0.4 billion worth of shares. That increased to 2015, $1.7 billion, 2016, $1.9 billion, and then last year, 2017, they spent over $2 billion in share buybacks. Now, share buybacks are only really effective if the company is buying them back at a good price. So we have to remember that. So let's dig into the dividends a little bit more. So in 2011, the dividend rate was $0.109 per share. So this increased to $0.527 a share in 2017. Now that's a quintupling of the dividend over a 7-year period. So that's actually really, really good. That's a 25% year-over-year growth rate over the past 7 years. So Discover has been increasing their dividend a lot. It's just that as a percentage of their overall profit and as a percentage yield relative to the stock price, it's been very low. For example, I think the yield on Discover stock right now is somewhere around 2%, which I think it's the highest it's ever been, maybe, or close to that. So as far as the share repurchases, let's analyze this a little bit and try to figure out if this has been in the interest of shareholders, because a lot of times companies will brag that, oh, we've been authorized to repurchase billions of dollars in stock and we're returning cash to shareholders. But then what they don't tell you is that they're issuing tons of stock to their executives and basically wiping out all of the money that they just spent on buybacks. They're giving it right back to their executives. And so the stockholders aren't really enriched by that. It's just kind of a wash. So the way that we can tell is through the net number of shares listed on the annual report at the beginning of each year. And this is actually on the very first page of the annual report, so it's really easy to see. So in 2011, there were 529 million shares. And then I went through every annual report from 2011 through 2017. And I noticed that every single year, the share count has been declining a little bit more. So 497 in 2012, 470 in 2013. I won't bore you with all the numbers, but all the way up to 2017, 354 million shares. So Discover went from 529 million shares outstanding in 2011, all the way down to 354 in 2017. So that's a big reduction. If you calculate that out, that's a 33% reduction in share count over the past 7 years. So in the last year alone, Discover reduced their share count by 8%. I mean, this is massive. They're like gobbling up their stock. And I think the reason they're doing this is because they're saying, hey, like, we're not Visa, we're not MasterCard, but we do have a profitable business and we're going to reward our shareholders in the ways that we can. So companies, it's not really fashionable for companies to pay dividends as much anymore. And there's also like tax reasons that they don't want to do that because it's kind of a double tax on corporate profits to pay out a dividend, because the investor has to pay taxes on the dividends of profits that the company was already taxed on. So it's not as tax efficient, but buying back shares is more tax efficient and theoretically will raise the stock price because there are less shares to go around. And so the earnings per share of the company increases. So yeah, so Discover has reduced their share count massively over the past few years. And looking at the rate of reduction year over year, they've really been increasing it and stepping it up. In the past 3 years, they've reduced the share count at least 7% per year since 2015. So this is interesting because it kind of tells you the mindset of management and how they're playing this, how they're thinking they're going to reward shareholders for investing in Discover. So what's the outlook of this company look like? Well, according to management, they expect the charge-off rate to increase somewhat, actually. They've put away more money for loan loss provisions in 2017, substantially more than they did the few years prior. They expect that to continue, which tells you that the credit profile of their average consumer is becoming a little bit more risky, and they're not paying off their loans as much as they have over the past several years. So they're kind of expecting this. They're expecting net margin in the interest they're making to increase slightly because of rate increases. So in the United States, as I mentioned before, the federal funds rate pretty much determines the going rate for credit in the economic system. And so over the past several years in America, this rate has been increasing little by little. We've seen rates on mortgages increase little by little, which is also set to the prime rate. Rates on loans increase little by little. And so ultimately, that helps companies like Discover. So they have run simulations that would look at their assets and liabilities and their income and expenses because they're heavily influenced by interest rates. So what would happen if there was a 1% increase in interest rates? Well, Discover predicts, based on their simulations, that a 1% increase in rates would increase their net interest income by 2%. Now, this is interesting because it tells you that, hey, if we enter an inflationary environment in the United States, who are the companies that are immediately going to benefit? Yep, it's the credit card companies and it's the banks, because there's going to be more transactions and the volume of those transactions because of increased interest is going to increase. So that's an important driver for future returns for companies like Discover Financial. So we'll see if that happens in America. I don't know. I have a feeling that it will, because the United States has so much debt right now that the way to get rid of that or lower the impact of that debt is to inflate our way out of it. So I do expect the Federal Reserve over a long period of time to increase interest rates above what they are right now, because we are near historic lows still in America in 2018. And when the Federal Reserve cut interest rates way back in 2008 timeframe, they were trying to spur economic growth and they have succeeded at that. And so now, a decade later, they're slowly increasing that rate. So I think inflation will be higher in the future than it is now. But of course, I don't know what's going to happen. Nobody does. No expert does. So that's kind of the overall thesis for Discover, is if you believe that interest rates will increase, then that could bode well for a company like Discover. Now, although Discover is smaller than its rivals, it's still one of the major players in the credit card industry. And people do use them to borrow money, and they do use them to process transactions. So they are a player in this space. They're not the biggest or the baddest, but they have been increasing their loans. They've been increasing their revenue. The problem is they just haven't been increasing their profit very efficiently. So that's something to consider. And also considering that they are buying back shares is interesting. So what about the valuation? So right now, in April 2018, as I record this, Discover is trading around $70. So based on last year's earnings, that's a price-earnings ratio of about 12.5 or 12.6. So historically, the price-earnings ratio went as low as 2 in 2009 when financial companies were just getting hammered more than everybody else. And typically, it seems that it trades in the 9 to 11 range. So Discover, probably a little bit on the expensive side historically, but that's where it falls as far as that one valuation metric. And as far as institutional ownership, it's heavily owned by institutions, between 87 and 92%. Now, pretty much all the companies I'm going to cover here on this series, they're probably going to have high levels of institutional ownership because they are in the S&P 500. So many funds and so many mutual fund companies are going to own these companies automatically because they're part of this huge index. So the way that I see Discover right now, it's got a 2% dividend yield, which is nice. It's about average, about in line with what the S&P yield is right now. Its earnings growth, I don't really expect much earnings growth from this company. It hasn't grown earnings over the past several years. It doesn't seem like it's good at doing that. It's good at increasing transactions and increasing business, but not necessarily increasing profits. So I would expect 0 to 2% earnings growth from this company. Now, as far as the buybacks, this does influence total return. So I do expect 6 to 8% of the share count to be reduced every year through buybacks. So we have a 2% dividend yield, 0 to 2% earnings growth, and 6 to 8% buybacks. So I expect most of the money that investors would make from this point forward from Discover Financial to really come from the reduction of that share count, to come from buybacks. So maybe if you add all those things up, you might get an 8 to 12% total return over the next several years. Now, of course, I have no idea if this will happen, but I do think that there is a decent chance of mid to high single digit rates of return from Discover because it's reducing its share count so aggressively, and it does have the cash flow to do it. It's not like it's borrowing all of this money in order to pay dividends and buy back shares like some companies do. They actually do have organic cash from operations that they're plowing back into eliminating these shares. So yeah, that's Discover Financial Services for you. And it's the first financial company that we've covered here on Stock Stories. I'm glad we're tackling these one by one and just learning as much as we can, trying to soak in that knowledge of different industries and different companies in order to make us better investors. That's the whole purpose of this podcast. So I hope that in some way I'm helping you achieve a greater level of knowledge than you had before listening to this episode. So with that, that is Stock Stories Episode 8. I'm your host, Alex, your stock storyteller, and I'll see you in the next episode. The information presented here on Stock Stories is for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only. You and you alone are responsible for your investment and financial decisions. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, or financial advisor that can analyze your specific situation in the context of your goals and circumstances.